We've heard the buzz about prefab modern, but is it really taking off in Los Angeles? I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA, Design and Architecture, broadcast on 89.9 KCRW and kcrw.com. In a time of skyrocketing house prices, prefab modern is being touted as a sustainable, stylish answer to an affordable home. So is it? More later in the show. Plus, designers pick their favourite sunglasses and Philippe Starck picks his favourite building in Los Angeles. But first, the beautiful game of soccer is very simple. It involves a bunch of players running around a field who try and kick a round ball between two posts. But the design thinking behind that ball has got a whole lot more complicated. Adidas won the contract to engineer this year's World Cup soccer ball, and the result has stirred up some controversy. Ken Bray is a sports science professor in Bath, England, and he's author of a new book, How to Score: Science and the Beautiful Game. Ken, great to have you on the programme.
Frances, it's really nice to be there, and I'm just thinking how much I envy you in California. The weather must be super.
I'm afraid to say it is. So let's hear about this new Adidas-designed soccer ball that's being used at this year's World Cup. Who knew that a ball could be redesigned?
Well, each year, of course, every manufacturer tries to produce a new ball for sporting occasions. And this time, Adidas have come out with probably the highest-tech football that's ever been kicked around a football field.
What is high-tech about this ball? And put it in the context of what were these balls previously made of?
OK, take the oldest ball of all, the ball that was played in the great traditional game in the Middle Ages. It was a leather casing stuffed with straw, the lowest-tech ball you could possibly imagine. By the time we get to the present day, we're talking about an object which is designed to be perfectly spherical, to have an absolutely tightly controlled weight, to move and bounce predictably when it strikes the surface.
Now, the old balls from the Middle Ages and on for quite a while were hand-sewn. They were made up of different pieces, weren't they, that combined made a sphere. Is that still the case?
No. This ball is certainly made to form a sphere, but it's made in a different way. As you say, Frances, if people think of the classic soccer ball, it was the ball with the hexagon patterns. It had 32 panels, and they were stitched together. And in stitching them together, of course, when you inflated it, it formed a very nice regular sphere. This ball, the Adidas ball, is made with only 14 panels. These panels are not stitched together. It's a synthetic material, a polymer, which is bonded at the seams by thermal bonding, by thermal welding. The point being that, in fact, it's the seams between the panel, formerly the stitching, that gave the ball its stability when it flies through the air.
And so now you're saying there's less stability.
Yes. And let's think of the end point of this particular ball. If you go to the ball with the fewest number of panels and the smallest amount of seam, we arrive at the familiar object, the baseball. And fans of baseball in the States will know, occasionally a pitcher serves up a wicked delivery called a knuckleball. And in a knuckleball, the baseball bobs about in flight, and of course, it absolutely confuses a batter. Now, this ball, with 14 panels, is much closer to a baseball in that regard. So if a kicker can kick it with very little spin, it will behave like a baseball in flight and not like a classical soccer ball.
What does this mean for the game itself?
The ball kicked with very little spin dodges about in the air. And in this case, goalkeepers are absolutely fearful of trying to catch the ball. Invariably, they'll try to punch it out or palm it out. And it's very disconcerting for a goalkeeper trying to make a save when the ball is doing this kind of behaviour.
But we haven't seen significantly more goals to date in this year's World Cup. So is it really proving that difficult for the goalies?
Oh, I'm watching these games closely, and in all the games I've seen so far, there is evidence to support the concern of goalkeepers. This ball is doing something quite special in the air.
There's an enormous amount of trouble, clearly, that's been gone into here to redesign what I'd thought was the spherical equivalent of the wheel. I didn't know it could be reinvented to this degree. How much sort of investment and time might a company like Adidas put into winning the contract to provide this year's World Cup soccer ball?
Well, an enormous amount, Francis. And if we think of this ball, as I've said, apart from one potential problem, this ball is the most perfect one that's been used so far. But hey, wait there. Adidas have another trick up their sleeve. They have a ball which they fitted with a microchip. And you'll know in soccer, very often, we have instances where a goal is scored or isn't it scored. We don't know exactly whether the ball has or hasn't crossed the goal line. Well, this smart ball, as Adidas call it, has got a microchip inside which transmits its position continuously. And so in the future, when this new ball actually gets into action, it will be even higher tech than the present Adidas ball. And believe me, when we get that ball, we will resolve a few of the problems in soccer. So Adidas spend an awful amount of money investing technology, very high technology, in these very simple objects.
Ken Bray is a scientist at the University of Bath specialising in the science of sport, and he's the author of a new book, How to Score, Science and the Beautiful Game. Ken, thanks so much for talking to me on DNA.
You're very welcome.
I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA, broadcast on 89.9 KCRW and kcrw.com. Tomorrow's the start of summer, which means it's time to slip on what our president calls the shade look. I asked a few people in the design world what they're wearing this year.
I'm Carlo Cacavalli, Director of Special Events with the American Institute of Architects in Los Angeles. And my sunglasses are a pair of vintage Ferrari, like the car. And actually, they are racing sunglasses, so they're foldable sunglasses from 1979. They are teardrop aviator style. They are a smoked, tinted lens going from some sort of like gray purplish to transparent. And they fold in six pieces, so they turn out to be like a small teardrop shape that you can zip into a small leather pocket, so to speak, and you can put them in your sports jacket pocket.
And you don't wear them just for driving. You can sort of impress your friends when you walk into the bar wearing them.
Well, I try not to be that obvious, but yeah, sometimes I fall into that trap. And, you know, I wear them at night and they look cool and everybody look at me and that makes me feel good. That's a little sad, but that's okay.
Hi, this is Mary Norris. I'm a contemporary art consultant located in Los Angeles. I buy all of my glasses exclusively at LA Eyeworks on Melrose Avenue, and my current favorites are actually quite amazing. They're big frames, and they're plexiglass. The front is a light rust color. The lens are pale pink. One ear stem is turquoise and the other ear stem is acid green. I get lots and lots of compliments about these. As I say, I like to buy them on sale because sunglasses, the really cool ones, are so expensive, and LA Eyeworks does have at least two sales a year so that I can afford to keep up with my habit of having, I guess you want to say, groovy glasses.
Mary, can you define for me groovy sunglasses?
I would say hip or cool, whatever the current vernacular is. So I think right now, very big seems to be in.
Which harkens back to the 70s, which
yes.
Of course was groovy.
I see.
I'm Nick Hafamas, the chair of the graphic design department at Art Center College of Design over here in Pasadena. And I'm wearing currently Ray-Ban, the cop glasses, the aviators. My fascination with these specific glasses, the shape of glasses, pretty much stems from when I first got interested in sunglasses, maybe at the age of 12. Back then I put them on, I really liked them, but they looked really poor on me. It just looked super dorky. I didn't have the chin probably for it, and I was really frustrated with it. And about 20 years later, I put them on again, and they didn't look so bad anymore. So that pretty much got me hooked on them. Also, these glasses, they became fashionable again probably early 2004 in hometown Berlin. So they started popping up everywhere. That might have been connected with Kill Bill, the movie, where the cop had all of this assortment of glasses, aviator glasses, on his dashboard, and he could choose the color of the lenses according to his mood or to the color of the crime scene. So that was, everyone thought that was pretty cool. And then the interesting part was when I then came over to the States, early 2004, no one had them. They were still considered the old cop glasses, so people gave me very, very funny looks for it. And then it took about another 6 months to kick in over here.
Hello, my name is David Lai, and I'm the creative director at Hello Design. And my favorite pair of sunglasses are my Oakley Pro M frames. And basically, these glasses, they look like a U if you look at them from the top. Quite unique in the sense that you've probably seen them on Lance Armstrong, but actually these have been around for quite a few years, and one of the things that I just love about them is they're one piece, so there's no hinges. And what's great about that is that, you know, I always have hinges that break on glasses, and these things you just sort of put on your face. There's no sort of wrap around on the back of the ears. They actually just go straight out, and there's some rubber pieces on the end that keep them secure to your head. And there's this just sculptural quality to these glasses.
Oh, a bit like the characters in X-Men.
Yes, exactly. In fact, he might be wearing a pair of Oakleys, I think.
Hi, I'm Jade Chang. I'm the West Coast editor at Metropolis Magazine. And this summer, as I did last summer, I'm wearing a big pair of sort of 70s-style tortoiseshell sunglasses, but they are not Gucci or Prada or anything else fancy, because I lose every single pair of sunglasses that I ever own probably within about 2 months. So I buy mine actually in bulk at the Fairfax flea market, the flea market at Fairfax High School, from one of the vendors there, and I probably buy 3 or 4 pairs of the same glasses every single time. So that when I lose the pair that's in my car, I still have the pair that's in my purse.
Now go out and get yourself some fitted black frames with the glass so dark they won't even know your name. And the choice is up to you, cause they come in two classes. Rhinestone shades of cheap sunglasses.
This is Frances Anderson. You're listening to DNA. After this break, Philippe Stark will tell us about his favorite building in Los Angeles.
Support for DNA comes from Design Within Reach, featuring modern designs including Herman Miller, Knoll, and Casina, all under one roof. 7 locations throughout the Southland area, including Beverly Hills, Santa Monica, Beverly Boulevard, Manhattan Beach, and Newport Beach.
This is Frances Anderson, back with DNA. This month, 2 world-famous designers have made their mark on Los Angeles. Tadeo Ando, the revered Japanese architect of minimalist spaces, has designed a George Jensen jewellery store on Rodeo Drive in Beverly Hills. The walls of the long, narrow boutique are lined with light tubes emitting a blue hue. Think a zero-gravity corridor in something like Kubrick's 2001. The store opens Thursday. And this week, the French designer Philippe Stark is here, putting the final touches to Katsuya. That's a new Japanese restaurant in Brentwood, created by nightlife impresario Sam Nazarian, the chef Katsuya Uichi, and Philippe Stark. The space is calm, symmetrical, with sloping ceilings. It's lined top to bottom in pale wood like a box, with white chairs and sofas, set off by large-scale erotic images of a Japanese beauty. I visited Stark in the restaurant yesterday, and while there we talked about his design, we talked about design and architecture, and I asked him about his favourite building in Los Angeles.
There is one which is called the Chemosphere, designed by Lautner, and owned now by my friend Benedict Taschen. I love this flying saucer, with just a pod like that, it's a column. I love this building because it's really the essence of the American dream of, I don't know when it was done, the 60s, 50s, I don't know. And it's purely modern. It's not, oh my God, it's a good test or bad test. We don't care about people will say it. We don't care about neighbor will say it. We do it. It was a time when America had a dream to share the famous American dream, American way of life, and that was a beauty. It's about believing in science, because it's very technical. And the image of the flying saucer like that, it's a real hope. There is something very positive. Now, so many buildings are just, you know, to look rich, to look powerful, to look trendy, to look I don't know what. In this one, they don't want to look anything. It is. It's about the future. And me, I am so concerned. It's my only passion. Think about our animal species, our civilization, our evolution, our speed of evolution. That's why I try always to not look modern, but to be really modern. And to be modern, it's a structure of thinking. It's not a color, it's not a shape, it's not design. And this was structurally modern.
That was Philippe Stark talking about the Chemosphere House in the Hollywood Hills, designed by John Lautner. The Stark-designed Katsuya opens next Monday. It's at 11777 San Vicente Boulevard. There's been a lot of talk in recent years about prefab housing in a clean, modern style. Despite the buzz, however, to date there have not been many modern prefabs built in the LA region. But that's starting to change. Jennifer Siegel is the principal of the Office of Mobile Design, and she's just installed a small prefabricated show home on Abbot Kinney. I went to take a look at it, and she told me about the day it arrived.
It was incredibly exciting to be standing on the street corner and watch your entire house arrive on this truck.
So it came, it literally arrived in one day.
Absolutely. Within 30 minutes, the truck pulled away, and I walked into the front door.
And you've designed it, and describe it for us.
This particular building is a single modular building, and it's made of steel. It comes pre-assembled on a truck. It is 60 feet long, 12 feet wide, so it's 720 square feet. And the idea is that someone can walk into the space, kick the tires, feel what the real thing feels like, and start to imagine what the possibilities might be.
Now, you say this came on a truck. Did it come in one piece? The entire structure came in one piece. Is that correct?
That's correct. Everything is installed in the building when it leaves the factory, from the kitchen sink to the flooring, the appliances, the sound system, all of our sort of high-end green materials as well.
So talk a bit about the green materials. There's some quite distinctive materials in here. Just describe a few of them.
The flooring is bamboo and coconut palm. There are materials on the walls that are more environmentally sensitive. So there's a material called Kirei. That's a Japanese grass product. There is another finished material on the wall called Finply, or finished plywood. The kitchen comes from Boffi, an Italian kitchen company, and the bathroom items as well. And then at the very front of the building, there's a beautiful light wall that's made from polygal, or it's a polycarbonate insulated plastic.
Now, you just mentioned Boffi supplied the kitchen. Boffi's kind of quite high-end, I think. Is this an affordable product that we're talking about here, or is this rather more aimed, is it aimed at a more affluent market?
I think it depends on one's definition of affordable in this market. This is an example of a very design-oriented building, so there are high-end aspects, and there are some very reasonable kind of middle-range materials as well. So what I'm trying to express is a mixture of ideas.
So this is creating prefab for the design-conscious market.
I would say that's really true. And you're looking at a modern structure that's probably half the cost of what traditional high-end modern architecture is on the west side.
Let's just talk about the exterior. It does have an industrial look about it. Can these materials be customized? Can people have other choices?
Right now, we're in the process of doing over a dozen custom houses for our clients around Southern California. Some of them are two stories. Some of them are U-shaped courtyard buildings up to 4,000 square feet. So it's important for the listeners to understand that anything is possible.
There's a lot of hype about prefab now, but you were on this sort of several years ago. What got you going in the first place?
It came from research that I was doing as a professor at Woodbury University, and also my personal travels and my experiences in living a very nomadic lifestyle. I started to look at what a trailer park was like and what a trailer was, and I also received a grant from Southern California Edison to help them rethink the portable classrooms. And it was that research that I started to realize that the structure that the portable classrooms were built from could easily be brought into the residential mode or factory setting. And that's how I began to make this transition from research into reality.
Jennifer Siegel, founder and principal of the Office of Mobile Design. We're standing in her showcase prefab house on Abbot Kinney. Thanks so much for showing it to me.
It was a real pleasure.
Jennifer Siegel's prefab at 1650 Abbot Kinney Boulevard will be open to the public Tuesdays and Fridays starting today. But hers is not the only prefab modern house in Los Angeles. A company called Living Homes has almost completed its first model on Highland Avenue in Santa Monica, designed by the great architect Ray Cappy. That's open by appointment. And Marmel Radziner and Associates, known for restorations of mid-century modern houses and high-end contemporary homes, are now producing a line of modular homes. Does all this mean the prefab dream is a new reality for Los Angeles? Michael Sylvester is the publisher and editor of FabPrefab.com. He consults to a number of prefab companies. Michael, welcome to DNA.
Thank you.
And we're talking today about prefab. There is such a buzz about prefab. What substance is there to the buzz?
There's a lot of people's dreams and ideals tied up in prefab, that's for sure. It offers the mythical half-price house with beautiful design. I think the reality of it is probably not as fantastic as people would like to hope. There's still some fantastic products available, very reasonable pricing, but some people have unrealistic expectations about what prefab can offer them, that's for sure.
So what can prefab offer them at present? And by the way, you refer to it as a product.
Yes.
So enlighten us as to why we're talking here, a product as opposed to a house.
Right. I deliberately use the word product in this context because I think what we're seeing is architects learning to practice a form of packaged architecture. These architects are learning from large production home builders that build acres of McMansions every week across this country. They have predictability nailed. You can see the home and you know exactly what you're going to get and what it's going to cost. It's very understandable. And what we're seeing in prefab is architects inching towards that model without abandoning their design discipline and the sensibilities they bring to the quality of the space.
Why does prefab never really take off?
There are a few reasons why it's failed to take off in the past, and I think the practitioners today have learned from that. One of the reasons it's failed in the past is that the people trying in previous eras were taking on too much. There were people that were trying to reinvent the whole construction puzzle. They built huge factories. They were trying to design the best nail to be used in the best piece of wood with the best window in the whole house. They wanted to own the whole system. And what architects today are doing is learning to work within existing materials and fabrication systems. They're not biting off more than they can chew. And under the old models that failed, the companies that tried this needed to sell vast quantities of homes in order to recoup their investments in factory and equipment and so forth. The architects that are doing prefab today, almost all of them, bar maybe a couple, don't own their own factories. They're using someone else's factory. And really, they're assembling a group of key vendors that can help them do this. And so they can make money on each home that's sold one by one on a marginal basis. That's very different to a business model where you need to sell thousands every month just to break even. The other answer to the question is that a lot of these products don't compete on price with a different quality of home. You have to realize that a lot of this prefab is unlike other main production homes that are available. So you have to compare apples with apples. I'm not sure with some of these products that they need to be viewed as price competitive with mainstream tract housing. They need to be viewed as relatively affordable compared to custom architecture.
So how are they doing on that level? I mean,
people are hearing, you know, numbers bandied about like $150 per square foot, but what is really the cost?
Well, firstly, you have to remove the real estate component, the dirt, out of the puzzle. And it's difficult to give a price because the prefab vendors that we're seeing in this space are deliberately positioning their products at different price levels, just like automobile manufacturers do. If you say to me, how much does a car cost in Los Angeles? Well, you're talking about a Honda or a Bentley. And so we're seeing the whole gamut of product price points for prefab right now that vary in affordability and in quality.
And what might the lowest and what might the highest be?
Generally speaking, the lowest is probably, I'm going to get in trouble for these numbers, but the lowest is probably $175 per square foot, and the highest can be up to $300 a square foot. The difficulty in citing a number is that you have site-based costs that vary on a case-by-case basis. So someone who's in a nice flat piece of land, maybe in, say, Inglewood, is going to have different site-based problems or costs rather than someone that's on a steep slope in Mount Washington, for example. And so an architect or a prefab vendor can't know those numbers in advance. There are challenges with site-based construction. There's noise, there's mess, there's inefficient use of materials. There's a lot of waste on site construction. Everyone's seen the big dumpsters out the front of a job site full of what looks like a house worth of materials that are off-cuts and leftover pieces. And things get stolen from job sites. That doesn't happen with prefab. Everything is built in a clean, controlled work environment and arrives on a truck. Now, yes, you need to have prepared the site beforehand by pouring a concrete slab and making foundations and so forth, but the amount of site work is vastly lower than in traditional construction. It's something that in other parts of the country, the residents are more accustomed to seeing, because prefab is more prevalent in places where the weather is awful and they need to build inside for a lot of the year because it's difficult to build outside. We have beautiful weather in Southern California, and we also have an abundance of relatively affordable and mobile construction labor. That means this has not traditionally been a hotbed for construction. For prefab, rather, for those traditional reasons. But there are still benefits to doing prefab beyond those basic ones of being able to build in the bad weather and save money with economies of scale.
Your website is called fabprefab.com. So after all that you've said, what to you is really fabulous about prefab?
Sure. For me, fab prefab or great prefab is architects getting their ideas out to a broader market than they would otherwise be able to reach. I think there are some architects with fantastic ideas that traditionally haven't found an audience. Their ideas live on in paper or in renderings on computers. And I just want to encourage everyone to share great ideas and develop progressive housing.
Michael Sylvester, publisher and editor of fabprefab.com, an internet resource for prefab enthusiasts, also consultant to some prefab firms. Thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you, Frances.
For more information on prefab, go to our website at kcrw.com, keywords design and architecture. There's no doubt about it, design is hip these days, especially among teenagers. Just check out the crowds at Apple Store. So teens might be interested to know that some of the design schools around town are offering summer classes for kids. Otis College of Art and Design is offering a Summer of Art and Young Artist Workshop summer camps. And Art Centre College of Design holds Art Centre for Kids, workshops and classes throughout July and August. Go to our website for more details about these and other courses. I'm Frances Anderton. Thanks very much for listening to today's show. It was produced by Jennifer Ferrow and Ray Guana, with production assistance from Alyssa Walker. Thanks to Nancy Lieberman for managing the website. You can listen to this show or past shows anytime by going to kcrw.com, keywords, design and architecture. And you can also podcast the show on our website or iTunes. If you want to comment on design and architecture, write me at dna@kcrw.org. That's the letters, DNA@kcrw.org.